Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 21 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. If you watched Mary Poppins as a child, there's a good chance you remember her advice. In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun and snap, the job's a game. Even after watching that movie a million times, I was still not crazy about cleaning my room, but there's definitely something to be said for using a spoonful of sugar. One of the buzzwords in education these days is gamification, using games to get people more engaged with what they're learning. And this is precisely what the creators of Reacting to the Past are doing with post-secondary subjects. Reacting to the Past uses immersive games to get students working with primary sources and with each other to better understand history. This week, I spoke with Kyle Lincoln about his work creating and using Reacting to the Past games in the classroom. Kyle is the visiting assistant professor of classics at Kalamazoo College and a member of the Game Development Committee for Reacting to the Past. Here's our conversation on his work in progress, why immersive games are transformational for students, and how the skills they learn resonate far beyond the classroom. Thanks, Kyle, for joining me on the podcast to talk about using games to teach students about history. I'm happy to have you. I'm so excited to talk about this.
I appreciate the opportunity. You know, it's always nice to be able to share work, even when it's work in progress. And, you know, if it helps people whose classroom teaching could use a little bit more empathy, could use a little bit more on the soft skills and primary source readings, then, you know, that's a mitzvah in my book for sure.
Awesome. So the type of games that you're using, they're falling under the umbrella of reacting to the past. So can you tell me a little bit about reacting to the past and what it's for?
Sure. So in the late 90s, a Barnard College professor decided that he was finding teaching the Republic to 17, 18, and 19-year-olds a little bit difficult, right? Like it's an easy enough text to look at the words on the page, but unless you and Plato are on exactly the same wavelength, it can sometimes be a struggle the first time you read it. And so he devised an intensive immersive role-playing game. For, you know, listeners out there, I would sort of suggest that it's kind of on the model of like a Dungeons and Dragons, but like toned down a little bit and with a lot more historical content and boundaries, so that students could experience the ideas, you know, that are informing Plato's discourse and the tensions that are creating the context with which, you know, he's kind of sorting out all of the problems in contemporary Athens. And one of the things that he noticed, the Barnard College professor noticed, was that by getting students to play, they would often, because it's a mildly competitive environment, they would often go much deeper and form much more meaningful connections with the text. And so that sort of idea got workshopped for a couple of years. And starting really in the early 2000s, it sort of became this movement about using immersive gameplay in classrooms, not just history classrooms, but history, philosophy, political science. There's a lot of English games. There are a couple even that are being adapted for foreign language. Because the idea, of course, is that students are going to understand the primary sources that we teach them better if they recognize the inherent humanity in the authors that are crafting these texts, right? And so especially in classrooms where you're really kind of churning through material, giving students a chance to kind of revive the ghosts of the past and feel their humanity is kind of one of the big ideas behind Reacting to the Past. And what I particularly became enchanted by it was that, you know, if they did that sort of simulation for Athens, which was the first one I was exposed to when I was in graduate school in St. Louis, I think around 2012, so it was a couple editions ago because we're constantly revising these projects. What I noticed is that students who had gone through Athens would then read Augustus's Res Gestae or the Song of Roland or Columbus's Book of the Prophecies, right, where he pretends to be a prophet, with such dynamic ideas and with such energy, they would see the humanity in the text involved. And that, you know, had such a huge effect that I decided it was a movement that I wanted to be a part of. And then it very quickly became clear that there was a real desert between, there were a couple of really good antiquity simulations, but there were a ton of modern history, and especially modern American history, a refrain that's not too unfamiliar for most medievalists, right? There are 7 American historians for every medieval historian in the United States. And I'm sure the phenomenon is probably not as severe north of the border, but I'm sure that in Canada too. Well,
not so much.
You know, I'm sure in Canada, not quite as bad, I'm sure, but But still, you know, that there's a real need for dynamic medieval studies teaching that can really bridge the gap and do so in a way that demonstrates the inherent complexity and diversity of the medieval world without sugarcoating it in a way that can easily be pointed to as, you know, sort of fake teaching. So that's sort of what like brought me to Reacting to the Past, and it's what brought a couple of people in my graduate cohort and I to really sort of take a big investment in it. And so now, you know, what is it, 7 years later, I serve on the game development committee for the Reacting to the Past Consortium, which sort of helps take these projects from, you know, a sort of clever idea or an interesting set of primary sources and bring it as far as we can along the textbook project path. Because, of course, the end goal is to produce textbooks so that people who aren't as familiar with the pedagogy, who can't just take four or five primary sources and build this world out of it, can nevertheless get a lot out of their teaching by using these kinds of immersive activities in their classrooms to really expand and invigorate their teaching. So, I mean, that's sort of how I came to it originally. And that's sort of where I've kind of followed it from a more institutional path.
Right.
I'm not sure if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, totally. And I'm completely on board with getting students to react to the humanity of the people who were writing in the past. Let's get clear on what it involves, one of these reacting to the past games. So the one that you shared with me to give me a look at it was called 1204, The Fourth Crusade and the Remaking of the Medieval World. So when we talk about this being an immersive experience, what is that like for students who are taking a course on 1204?
That's a really good question. And I think it's an important one because when people think game, right, they think frivolity. They think an unserious classroom. But I would actually suggest that, you know, medievalists, especially those of us who work in a lot of Latin sources, have a really good framework for understanding what this is, right? The Latin word ludus, right, L-U-D-U-S, means both game and school at the same time, of course, originally because Romans thought school was supposed to be fun and a leisure activity. But I think it maps really well into understanding how play can be illustrative. So in this case, what we do is we say, okay, the Crusades are this intense, religiously motivated, socially transformative, economically challenging, militarily diverse activity, right? The Crusades are huge. And so one of the things that we often look for in crusade studies are these big changes, right? At what point does crusading no longer have to focus just on the Latin East, right? That's a pretty early development, but it takes a while to really become solidified. At what point does crusading become a measure of society's value, right? Especially after the Second Crusade, that's sort of Bernard's big explanation. One of the things that's really fascinating about 1204 is that, you know, perhaps with some earlier exceptions against Marquard von Anzwiller and against the King of Leon, in the 1160s and the early 1190s, this is probably the first case of crusaders crusading against other Christians. And the Fourth Crusade in this case, right, becomes this moment where you can ask like how crusades go wrong and how that changes things. So from the individual student perspective, we put the students in the headspace, right? We give them, in most cases, a 9 to 12 page like dossier about, okay, you, Danielle, you're going to play Baldwin of Flanders, and the student sitting next to you is Boniface of Montferrat, and the guy two chairs back and three chairs over is the troubadour who's been following Boniface around trying to get a job, right? And like he's on the make, his career looks pretty great, but maybe he's not quite there yet, right? And so we get these really kind of dynamic and full-bodied characters for students to understand a lot of different parts about the medieval world, right? So even if they're not playing a very wealthy lord and understanding, you know, what noblesse oblige looks like and what leadership and warfare looks like, if they're in the shoes of a Robert of Clary, they get a sense of what a poor knight from, you know, a relatively poor province in Brittany looks like. If they're in the position, say, of a Catalan troubadour, they learn a lot about chivalric poetry. If they're in the case of a figure like the Empress Agnes, they get a sense about what ruling women look like. And if they play in a large enough class, I think he's right now listed in classes with about 30 students, they can even sort of get into the complexity of the relationship that the Kingdom of Abyssinia of Ethiopia has with the larger Christian world and explore, you know, what Lalibela's relationship with Christianity in the Greek Orthodox world, but also the Latin Christian world might have been, and how that might animate them. And so by putting students in the positions of these historical figures to try and sort out the really messy choices that must have been behind documents that are simple in their appearance, but that we know were intensely negotiated, documents like the March Pact of 1204, we get a lot of that complexity coming out with real human agency and with the kind of deal making that suggests that medieval people are just as complicated as modern people, right? They're just as clever. They're just as inventive. The difference is that they don't have Google, right? So they have to rely on the traditions and the ideas they've been brought up with. And that allows students to really dive in from a research focus to understand what their characters would have understood. But it also gives them some agency to see how historical ideas and arguments shape the larger set of activities they engage with. And so usually these simulations take place over the course of a week or two. You know, it's sort of a unit on the Crusades would sort of culminate with this kind of simulation. And so they debate the terms that they're going to divide the city up under in a couple of days. You know, if God willing, they take over. And of course, the clerical characters are super intense about, like, no, we're on the right side or we're on the wrong side, depending on the political views. And then students get to attack the city, and they play through a version of the sack of Constantinople. We've sanitized out of a few of the parts that I think no reasonable person would object to having removed, right? There are certain acts of violence in war that we're just not going to replicate. But one of the things that John Gibfried, who's my co-author, and I really kind of focused on was making sure that students could have agency in the process of the sack and understand how, you know, medieval Christians who have been told, you know, Constantinople is this glorious city filled with relics now becomes this object of looting in the middle of a crusade that's been redirected or misdirected from its original target at Alexandria to its target in Constantinople. And so once they get through that sack module, which is sort of formulated a lot like a choose your own adventure novel where they have a series of choices and it shapes a sort of storyboarded version of what they do, they're left to pick up the pieces and decide how to build a new empire in Constantinople and how to further the goals of the crusade. And, you know, the classes fail to achieve any lasting territorial conquest in most occasions, in large part because by replicating within a certain careful plausibility the results of the crusade, they can learn the same kinds of lessons that we can about the crusading movement. And so especially for intro classes that are talking about the crusade, that are talking about medieval warfare, they're talking about the medieval world in conflict, you can really sort of see a lot of different social and cultural traits being played out in this intensely military, political, and economic struggle. So that's sort of a kind of broad overview of what they're up to. There are a lot of twists and turns. One of the things that can happen is that students in the process of sacking Constantinople can come in possession of relics, as David Perry's wonderful book, Sacred Plunder, and of course, Patrick Geary's much earlier book, Furtus Sacra, we're able to demonstrate, right, the ability to come into possession of a relic is a big deal. And so if you playing as a student that's playing Baldwin of Flanders come in possession of a relic, you know, we actually give instructions on how to make admittedly a much cheaper but nevertheless a reliquary to hold your new relic to demonstrate your increased social prestige. And one of the things that gets students to do is consider all of the ways that these complex historical actions, like a crusade or like the trial of Joan of Arc or like the Black Death visiting a town, can really animate medieval people. And it, again, exposes their humanity, but it also exposes the humanity and the perspective of the primary sources that they're dealing with. And in the process, I think, gives them a much richer understanding of the medieval world.
This is kind of likened to a very intense and obviously much more sophisticated, like a murder mystery that you get at a dinner party, right?
Yeah.
Everybody is given a character and they have to stay in that character for the entire time. And they piece together clues and figure out how things run. And this is kind of very similar to that in that everyone is given a character that they have to stick with. And then, like you say, in this one particular 1204, they have to decide whether or not, as Christians, it's right to sack Constantinople. And then they have to decide how they're going to do it. And then they're going to decide what to do afterwards. And these are all, as you say, like really intense debates that they would have in the context of their characters. And you're basing these characters on primary sources, right? So their backstories are coming from what?
Yeah. So that's a really good question. One of the things my co-author, John Gibfried, who was actually a Fourth Crusade scholar himself, a Latin Empire of Constantinople scholar, he would want me to say, just to make sure that someone mentions the Latin Empire of Constantinople once a week somewhere in the world. One of the things that John actually sort of took the lead on was, in large part because he knows the sources, whether it be, Vihardouane or Robert of Clary or Nikitas Koniades, the Byzantine historian of the empire from Trebizond, was able to do, right, is really give us these deep and rich narrative portraits of a lot of these leading figures. And so in addition to the Venetian chronicles that are fragmentary in parts, but also extant for the later period, the number of Frankish, Northern Imperial, Byzantine sources that all kind of give us these narratives. We also have a lot of characters who are based on figures that appear in confirmations and in wills, who figure in prosopographical collections, whose social status and position are less knowable beyond sort of the perfunctory facts, right? We know that so-and-so is a merchant, he lives in this district, he mostly traded in these things, and he made his will on such and such a date, right? But these sort of, even these shell characters, which in much larger classes usually get deployed because, there's a little bit less narrative teeth to them, but having lots of people provides for redundancy in case somebody gets sick and can't give, their stirring, rallying speech on a particular issue. Having even these characters that are prosopographical in their origins as sort of narrative portraits allows us to continue exploring issues so that, we can get characters, a cleric who's maybe lukewarm on attacking Constantinople, but adamant about making sure the relics leave the city, or who is perhaps, nonplussed about the power of relics, but super enthusiastic about becoming the next patriarch of Constantinople. And so in the process, even when we have characters that aren't, for example, Geoffrey of Villehardouane and Robert of Clary are both playable characters in the game. And so one of the things that we usually ask those characters in particular to do is to make, often we ask them to write, sort of the student's version of what their players have done, because obviously students' classes are never going to replicate historical events when they play through it. And we always leave sort of some wiggle room in there so that they can float within the boundaries of what is historically predictable. Students then get into the act of, okay, what does a medieval chronicle look like? What does a medieval chronicle look like when it's a very wealthy and famous marshal from the Champagne? What does it look like when he's a poor knight who has, barely a patch of dirt to his name? How do those chronicles reflect their authors? How do they reflect the social situation? How do they reflect the tensions in camp and the kinds of politics? So that even in these characters that are very rich in the medieval record, students can see how they might have been different. And in the process, really get a sense of how context determines what they talk about. And one of the elements that's really important in every reacting to the past simulation is a kind of breakdown. I usually sort of playfully, to kind of get my students to let their guard down, refer to it as a feelings day at the end so that they can share their feelings about what they were experiencing. And one of the things they often talk about is the way they were really able, in some instances, to shed their modern perspectives and really think in a medieval fashion. But in others, they'll often share like how difficult it was for them to adopt medieval personas and how that changed the way they acted. And one of the things, of course, that gets them to do is to think about how who they are and who their characters are created different scenarios. So that even in the case of these characters where we have really rich biographies, for example, a Boniface of Montferrat, right, who is this from a famous family whose crusading pedigree is the stuff of, I'm sure, other podcast episodes, whether it's Conrad's murder or any of their Byzantine shenanigans. These are characters that have pretty rich primary source records, and where they don't, they're coming from a place where we can very easily reconstruct, sort of by outlining the negative space around them, what their world and life might have looked like. And we can give a lot of diverse perspectives on the issues for students so that you get a really rich and vibrant debate that makes sure that students who normally would sit in the back of the class and play on their phone are instead furiously at the back of the class taking notes from, an article they're finding on medievalist.net or on JSTOR about their historical issue, and quickly running over to the other members of their faction of their team to tell them, hey, we can't do that because canon law says this, but we can do this because it allows for that. And exploring that richness and that dynamism really starts with having these really rich and really well done characters, which John has built so that the larger architecture of the kind of game pieces that I've been sort of laying down really work together to make sure that the students are getting both an individualized learning experience, but also a collaborative one that makes them really consider how these sources overlap and shape one another and shape the perspectives that, we as historians and as medieval studies scholars run into all the time, right? There's never a simple answer. And that's something that I think really starts with the characters and reacting. Because, of course, as humans, we're not simple, which I like that art imitates life, imitating art.
Yeah, and I want to get into soft skills in a minute, but I really like how this encourages students to critically think about the source material and about the context, because that's something, you know, especially in post-secondary education, you're truly getting students to look at sources in the real world and think about context. And I think it's really great that this critical thinking is built in. Something else that you mentioned that I think is a really important part of the project is public speaking and debate, which is something that is one of the major aims of this. So what kind of public speaking and debates will the students be getting into when they're making these arguments for whether or not to sack Constantinople, for example?
One of the things that I think is really important for students, especially becoming increasingly important in our contemporary world, is that they be able to model respectful but still intense and deliberate disagreement, right?
Oh, for sure.
That things can be adversarial but not hurtful, right? That they can be intense but not overwhelming. And so one of the things that that students are bounded by are the rules of their age. You know, in games that take place in the Roman Senate, whether it be the trial of Catiline or the reconciliation of the Ides of March, or the altar of victory debates in the late 4th century, they're always bounded by the conventions of their world, right? So, for example, often one of the things that happens, and it's in large part because of some of the prompting in the character sheet, Boniface of Montferrat sort of sits back and says, you know, I'm the leader of this crusade, but I need your counsel, right? As part of a way of modeling the sort of collaborative nature of feudal warfare, of needing allies to ride to your assistance. And so that often leads Boniface to open with persuasive sort of, please tell me what I need to know. And it also, in a lot of cases, leads to students modeling perspectives that are different from their own, right? I mean, to my knowledge, there are not going to be any 12th century Venetian tradesmen in a modern medieval studies classroom, right? It's possible, I suppose. There are still DeLoreans driving around. But in most cases, getting students to model the ideas of a Venetian tradesman or of a Frankish lord or of a Provençal troubadour or of a German cleric, they're often going to be thinking from very different worlds. And I think one of the things that we often undervalue is not just the idea of hearing someone else's speech, right, and understanding their ideas. But, you know, there's that old Latin aphorism, he who teaches learns twice, right? And I think there's something to that, right, that by speaking in defense of someone else's ideas that might be very different from your own, you really kind of grow those skills of being able to listen and to argue, you know, in a persuasive manner. And I think especially for characters who have different or particular projects that are maybe not important to the student in question, right? And so it's not just sort of arguing the opposite of what you believe, but arguing something that you not only didn't know about, but have no reason to care about. It really puts students in a position to have to learn about ideas that they might disagree with or not understand very well. And in that process, it really lets them shape the way they talk to one another, whether it's in sort of collaborative, the backroom dealing, if you support this move, we'll support yours. Or in the formal speech environment of debates in Boniface's tent, you really sort of get a sense of students listening and speaking to one another and hearing not only the ideas behind it, but also the context that's being shaped. And so, you know, especially in this sort of public speaking, public listening, debate, collaborative model, it really gives students a chance to not only learn a lot of historical content, but in the process, sharpen those skills that are so intensely employable. One of the second benefits of that is that because most of our students are not going to be medieval studies majors, they're not going to go on to be professional medievalists. They're not going to go on to be professional historians or political scientists, but instead we'll find other, hopefully, well-paying and gainful, meaningful employment. Those skills development and the empathy building that happens in a reacting classroom often leads to empathy for a subject matter. So that, you know, in the future, you'll have, yeah, a CPA who's running, you know, a chain of local restaurants and doing sort of the operations management. But this is also somebody that's still going to go to the opening night of an art gallery, because once upon a time, they played a reacting game about building the Duomo of Florence. And they understand how art can motivate and empower a society and a people. And they form a deeper connection to art and art history. Or when we talk about competing ideas, there's a real tension to think like it's us against themism, run riot. But in the case of the Fourth Crusade, that's never the case, right? There's always overlapping agenda. And so getting students to listen and think in a reacting classroom often leads to long-term dividends. Some of the first generations of reacting students have started running for political office, and in a lot of cases, they're winning. If memory serves, recently in New York, Missouri, and Texas, in the last year's slate of elections, mostly state legislatures and local boards, you know, reacting students have been winning in large part because they're able to listen, they're able to advocate what they believe in a meaningful and respectful way. And I think that starts in a reacting classroom, right? Those are skills that have to continue to develop. But I think often, you know, when we plant a seed in play, we reap it in higher learning later on. And that sort of public speaking and debate angle is important to reacting. And that having been said, right, every reacting game also includes non-speaking roles, because it's important that we make sure that students who have challenges, whether for reasons of neurodiversity or for reasons of additional needs, there are lots of ways for people to continue to engage with these dynamic questions and continue to get more out of it than just watching a YouTube video about a historical topic or reading a book, right? Those are wonderful ways to learn, but they're not the only ways to learn. And by adding the kind of depth and engagement, even while listening, I think that can be a really meaningful way to do a lot of this skill development. You know, I routinely have faculty members who are curious about reacting come and sit in on my classes. And one of the things they're constantly saying is, you know, they're talking to one another. They're actually debating like primary source questions. They're not just saying, I read this, it said that, right? It's not read and report anymore, but actually a meaningful response.
I like that you have non-speaking roles, because I do think that's important to make sure that you're allowing people to play in a way that is comfortable for them. But for those students that do tend to sit in the back because they're not super engaged, there is a desire to speak and be involved, because there is a desire to win, which is a great a great motivator.
Right.
So how do you actually win these games?
Right. So that's a really good question. I should start off by saying that reacting is a very big tent, and so my approaches for grading are not gospel. And my co-author and I go back and forth on this a lot. Generally, what I default to is saying, you know, if reacting composes a chunk of your grade, the victory, like actually whether you won or lost, is at most 5 or 10% of that grade. So there's a small incentive to really work hard, right? But if you failed, right, if you as a student player, I'm going back to our Baldwin example. If Baldwin gets just absolutely massacred at the conquest of Constantinople, right, in history, he actually dies the next year in battle against the Bulgarian Khan Kaloyan, there is still an option for you to do well, right? You can completely lose, but win so much in the classroom in terms of what you learn that you still, you know, can leave with the A++++ that every student seems to be absolutely thirsty for in this whole process, right? Like they're constantly worrying about grades. And so one of the things that we build in is a set of victory objectives. Students who belong to a faction, who belong to a team, have sort of team objectives, but also every student has their own personal objectives, right? And this sort of makes sense, right? If we map it onto modern political parties, right, you can get individual MPs, individual congressmen who have big issues that they as a party member care about, but they also have, you know, individual concerns, whether it be for their local district or for their own political success and fortune, for an issue that they particularly care about, which may not be necessarily impactful on the global stage, whatever global might mean in this context, but it's still very important to them, right? And sort of it sets that tension between individual goal and team goals. And even for the characters who don't belong to factions, who start out as independent voters, one of the things that we often build into games, and which we've built in quite a few different ways in the 1204 game, are groups of independent characters, wildcard voters, who either are completely open-ended and whose job it is to listen to the speeches and the ideas and vote with whomever it is convinces them, or characters who are designed to introduce particular wrinkles to issues. The best example of this, I think, is the Byzantine general Theodore Branas, who is a part of the game. In history, he was sort of outside the city and not involved, or outside the question of the conquest of the city and not involved, but he's in the proximity enough that the idea that a Byzantine leader, right, whether a platoon leader on the other side of the Golden Horn, would participate in saying, like, hey, please don't burn the whole city down. It's actually a great city. Please don't destroy everything that's Greek, right? Allows us to build in the kind of sensitivity and the complexity of these questions that, you know, in the sort of typical medieval problem, right, we know they must have known about, but doesn't show up anywhere in a text where it would say, look at this primary source and how it talks about what to do about the Greek people. And so by introducing these wildcard voters, it gives those individuals much more personalized victory objectives that they can pursue and learn about, but it also introduces complexities so that you don't just get static votes of like, okay, we'll support you on A if you support us on B, right? And that kind of horse trading voting gets complicated when these indeterminate characters, these factionless characters, get introduced. And so each faction has its own, you know, goals. They want to see one of their faction members as emperor of Constantinople. They want to see a particular solution to the question of the Latin-Greek schism, which is, of course, still in full effect at this point, whether they want to go directly onto Jerusalem, whether they preserve the Byzantine system of pronoia, whether they give Venice a complete trade monopoly. I think you can reasonably guess that it's the Venetians who really want that one. And so finding both faction and character objectives helps to make sure that students who maybe are less assertive can blend into their team and play a role, even if it's not a big leadership one, and still get something out of that competitive exercise, even if they're not feeling brave enough, accomplished enough, or if they just get beat, which happens on their secret objective, on their personal objective, they can still participate meaningfully in the world that we sort of built around the Fourth Crusade. And so in a lot of cases, their objectives are political, right? That they get the solution to the problem, quote unquote, of Constantinople and the Crusades, and that they start to reshape the medieval world in a way that benefits them. You know, most of the characters in this game are, for better or for worse, inherently political, right? Even though in some cases they might not have said that themselves. And so how they achieve their political objectives within the process of this game kind of really sharpens that really collaborative instinct, but also sets up individual collaborations between students who maybe, in the case of the troubadour characters, of which there are a handful, and in larger classes as many as five or six, you know, they can all sort of learn about like what troubadour poetry looks like and can workshop each other's poems before, you know, delivering a really skewering appraisal of what Boniface's battle prowess looked like at the sack, or a particularly insightful poem about why a particular churchman has the best and wisest and holiest opinion, or why they need to throw all of the Greeks out of the camp, right? They're able to explore a lot of these options within both character and faction alignment settings.
I like that you're working with people's natural tendency to work together to accomplish their goals. And I think that's great because it will bring people together across their actual modern sensibilities in a way that's really useful and helpful. What has been the reaction of the students that have participated in these games as part of their courses?
To be a little cynical for just a moment.
For
junior faculty members, anybody that's pre-tenure or is on the VAP circuit, who's adjuncting, you know, a 12-12 or whatever you have to do to get by in your particular situation, there are enormous benefits for student engagement and for faculty-student relationship and mentorship building projects overwhelmingly reacting changes what course evaluations look like. Even the students that say, and, you know, there's always going to be one in a population of 100. Let's say this is, you know, this is dumb. We're playing make-believe. I hated this. I don't know why I had to learn about Robert of Clary's particular chronicle and how he shaped notions of aristocratic identity against the cause of the common knight. Right? Even when they're delivering these Jeremiads, these screeds in teaching evaluations, you can sort of point to them and say, like, well, yeah, but you just outlined the six reasons why Robert of Clary is an important source in the Fourth Crusade.
Exactly.
So I tricked you into learning. But I think students and other faculty observers alike respond to them enormously in a way that says, you know, this is a positive way for learning, especially in places where, you know, they might have come in with a context of an English class or a history class, a politics or government class, where it's a lot about names and dates and places, and identify the metaphor, the simile in this passage. Tell me what the main idea of this chapter was, or how this particular article of Confederation is different from this treaty of surrender. A lot of that perfunctory nuts and bolts stuff is very testable. But one of the things that makes a humanities education transformative is not testable, right? I mean, the first five letters of humanities is human, right? And I think the more we run away from the humanity of our subject, the more our students will run away from us because we're devaluing their contributions as humans. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I think in particular that students respond to is that this is a much more tangible way for them to understand the world that they're talking about, right? They not only understand the ideas intellectually, but they start to understand them emotionally. They get why people care about the schism between Latin and Greek Orthodox churches when they play the game that centers around the Council of Nicaea, which is available from Reacting Consortium Press. They get why the Yersinia Pestis outbreaks of the time of Pericles and the time of Justinian are terrifying because they're able to play Amy Brown Curry's Black Death Comes to Norwich. And they see what an epidemic does to people who are simply trying to hold on and maintain the small town of Norwich, right? And in the process, they think about, you know, what these changes in the medieval world can do for the people that were living then, right? Whether it's the trial of Joan of Arc causing people to question the role of God in their everyday lives, whether it's the monks of Iona trying to resist Viking invasions and what happens when a monastery is turned upside down, whether it's Eleanor of Aquitaine courting troubadours, or any of the games that take place in early Renaissance Florence that explore the reemergence of this hybrid of medieval and ancient ideas, bringing out this weird thing that, you know, sort of lump all together as humanism. It really demonstrates for students the vibrance of the world we're talking about, the vitality. And they reflect that. And they are constantly telling me about, you know, are you teaching another Reacting Games class, right? Sure. You know, and oftentimes I recommend for, you know, first or second level classes, right? The big, big surveys or the topic or theme surveys. But the thing that I've really been amazed by is that aside from being really good for recruitment numbers, because Reacting sort of attracts people and people say, you gotta take this class. It's got these things and we're going to do them and you got to come and I want you on my team. Beyond that, often the students that might be sort of attracted to take a history class or two or an English class or two are drawn in to become minors or minors become majors because they're seeing that vitality. So that in their upper division research courses, that vitality is something they already know and feel. And that vitality is something that gets reflected in their research projects. I just had, right now I'm teaching at Kalamazoo College, and every student is required to do a kind of senior thesis project. Fine arts students do, you know, a whole portfolio or a gallery opening. The scientists build a poster and do some kind of experiment. One of my students designed a game that reanimates the debate in book one of the Iliad about the repatriation of Perseus between Agamemnon and Achilles. Puts these characters from Greek myth and gives them humanity and vitality in a way that the Greek world would have understood them. The usual requirement for these kind of senior thesis projects, right, is for a 6-credit project as she did, is somewhere between 60 and 90 pages. She wrote 280 when it all was said and done.
Wow.
And I would submit that students don't normally go 4 or 5 times over the page limit for a project. They do so only when it really matters to them and when it really has a purpose for what they're doing. And I think one of the things that Reacting does is it gives students a purpose for why they're studying something that's outside their major or that's maybe close to it but not under that umbrella. And I think student reaction and also other faculty member reactions are pretty profound. I've been asked to demo these for some of the graduate students across the way. Or in the larger regional development of Michigan. And every year, new faces show up at the annual Faculty Institute in the summer in New York City or in the winter in Athens, Georgia. And we have new game designers showing up all the time for the Game Development Conference, which wanders around a little bit more every summer because, you know, this pedagogical model not only helps students develop skills, but it helps instructors develop lasting and meaningful relationships. And at a time when the humanities are under attack everywhere and where we are constantly having to advocate for why we should do these things, I think it's really meaningful that we can point to a teaching style that not only says why, but how we can do much better humanities teaching by teaching less and playing more, by embodying the duality of that Latin word ludus. We can really kind of come to a better understanding of what teaching and learning can be like when we're able to rediscover and redeploy the joy that brings us to our research subjects.
Well, I think you've just made a really great case for the humanities in general, because we know that employers are looking for those soft skills that come from humanities, whether they realize that or not. And a lot of the things that you are developing through this, empathy, critical thinking, the ability to speak and debate respectfully, these are all really important skills. And I think it's great work. And I'm really glad that we got to talk about it. So 1204, The Fourth Crusade and the Remaking of the Modern World is not out yet. Do you have a time when it might be out that people can find it?
We don't yet, but one of the beautiful things about reacting as a community is that you can find us all over, and we are constantly sending out demo versions, which are full-fledged but free, through our various outlets. You can find it. If you're a faculty member, you're more than welcome to join the Reacting Faculty Lounge on Facebook. If you are interested in seeing about any of the materials that are available for download or perusal, Reacting to the Past's website, which is hosted by Barnard, has a faculty library. You do have to apply for it. We do a little gatekeeping so that really clever students don't sneak in. But these projects are constantly being made available. And of course, I'd be happy to send copies to any faculty member that wants a copy of the instructor's manual, because these games get better the more we play them. And the case of the Fourth Crusade and the Remaking of the Medieval World, will get a better understanding of the Crusades for everyone when everyone starts to play along.
I think it's a great idea, and I'm really glad that you're doing that. And I'm going to make sure that we mention again where people can find out more and where they can find out how to get involved. So thank you so much, Kyle, for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about work in a way that's helpful. It's always a great opportunity. I really thank you for involving me.
It's a pleasure. For more of Kyle's work, you can search for Kyle C. Lincoln on academia.edu. To find out more about Reacting to the Past and how you can get involved, visit reacting.barnard.edu. That's reacting.barnard.edu. Or you can check out the Reacting Faculty Lounge on Facebook. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Yeah, we've got a couple of articles on 12th century texts that our columnists did this week. One is on a Byzantine text called the Digenes Acritas, and I hope I got that right. It's an epic poem, kind of love and battles and all that kind of fun stuff, so you can read that. And the other is on the Gesta Danorum, which is all these kind of legendary materials of Scandinavia. So this is kind of the pagan and early Christianity days kind of chronicle. So that's a lot of fun to read on the medievalist.net this week.
Thanks, Peter. As of this week, the Medieval Podcast has been downloaded over 50,000 times, and I want to thank each and every one of you for lending me your ears each week on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube, or wherever you're listening. Thanks for leaving reviews, thanks for telling your friends, and thanks for sharing us on social media. A special shout out goes to those people who've been keeping us going by contributing to our Patreon page. If you want to get in on the action, visit patreon.com/medievalists. As Peter said, there's always new stuff going on at medievalists.net, and you can stay up to date by following along on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. If you want to follow me, Danielle Sibelski, you can find me across social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist, or you can find my books on Amazon. As always, our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thank you for listening 50,000 times. Have yourself a wonderful day.